Is Social Security really going bankrupt?
The discussion you see a lot in the media is that Social Security is in a fiscal crisis, that it's going to go broke or go bankrupt, which is, first of all, it's incorrect. Social Security isn't under any kind of a threat of that sort, but it is in a political crisis.
That's Eric Larson. He says there's a war on geezers that hurts young and old alike. His book is The People's Pension. And Greg Palast counts up 9 ways Republicans are suppressing the vote and why it matters.
When I did the analysis for Billionaires and Ballot Managers, it's called How to Steal an Election 9 Easy Steps. You add them all up, it's 5.9 million votes from the 2008 election. You say, well, it didn't make a difference. Yeah, it did. 7 senators, Republican senators, would not have been elected. That would have changed America. And this time, it could change the White House.
We'll talk with him about his bestseller, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Mitt Romney heaps scorn on the 47% who depend on the government but don't pay income tax, some of those he was talking about are the millions of seniors on Social Security. Romney and his running mate Paul Ryan want to put limits on Social Security and privatize it, something Wall Street is licking its chops at. Regrettably, attacking Social Security is bipartisan. Under the cloak of saving the system, both centrist Democrats and Republicans talk about slashing benefits or raising the retirement age. But my guest Eric Larson says Social Security is solvent for many decades to come, and we don't need to slash benefits or raise retirement in order to put it on an even stronger foundation. Why it's under attack and what to do about it is the subject of his fascinating and important book, The People's Pension: The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. Eric Larson is an independent financial and political journalist and activist. Eric Larson, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, this book, The People's Pension, is the most complete treatment I think exists on the issue of Social Security. Is that correct?
Well, I would say it's the first comprehensive history that's ever been written of this 30-plus year period in which Social Security has basically been in a political crisis in this country. And what I mean by that is it's been under almost constant threat from at least some parts of the political spectrum in Washington who want to cut it drastically or privatize it or otherwise sort of dismantle the structure that was set up beginning in the New Deal.
You actually call it a war against the geezers. Mm-hmm. You know, let's cut to the chase here. Why is Social Security under attack?
Okay, well, as I said, it's under political attack. The discussion you see a lot in the media is that Social Security is in a fiscal crisis, that it's going to go broke or go bankrupt. You know, the moderator on the vice presidential debate used that term, going bankrupt, which is, first of all, it's incorrect. Secondly, Social Security isn't under any kind of a threat of that sort. But it is in a political crisis. So the question is, where did that come from? And it comes from a lot of changes that have happened in the political system and in the economy in this country in the last 40 years or so, dating back to the economic crises of the 70s. And number one is that the political spectrum in this country has shifted very far to the right, not just Republicans, but what you'd call center-right Democrats are a lot more conservative than they used to be. And they espouse a philosophy which essentially says that the United States has become a zero-sum society, which means that if somebody gets something, something has to be taken away from somebody else. And the way that affects Social Security is it's sort of ingrained in them this belief that if older people are doing well, or at least marginally well, because they're getting Social Security and Medicare, then somebody else must be doing badly. You hear this all the time, that we're not doing enough as a society to provide for the young, and somehow that's the fault of seniors who get Social Security benefits, along with the fact that those benefits are actually indexed to the cost of living. Even worse, we're robbing future generations in order to take care of this one, and that's what I call the war against the geezers. Again, it's incorrect. That's not really what happens. but it looks good when you can, you know, draw it in a graph on a piece of paper. Here's what we spend on the young, here's what we spend on the old. And it's used as a way to sort of bludgeon Social Security into submission ideologically. Now, there's other things that have happened. Wall Street has become much more interested in managing the assets that go into Social Security every year, and so they're very much in favor. The large institutions, mutual fund companies, have been pressing for a long time now for privatization of Social Security. At the same time, the economics profession has moved very far to the right, sort of the most influential portions of it, that is. And they tend to also espouse this philosophy that Social Security is somehow going to bankrupt us as a society. Again, it's not true. The estimates that we get from the Social Security Administration are that Social Security costs us as a society something like 4.5% of GDP. In other words, 4.5% of the total economic product of the country every year. That's not very much when you consider all that it does for us, the fact that older people are able to live on their own, not be a burden on their younger families, that they're putting money back into the economy in terms of consumer spending instead of just taking it out. They're not a burden on relief or welfare systems or systems for the homeless at the local and state level. There's all kinds of good things that Social Security does for us, not to mention it allows younger people to stay in school. Paul Ryan has admitted that as much for himself, that it enabled him to stay in school when he had a working parent die. So 4.5% of GDP. Now the actual deficit that Social Security is supposed to run over the next 30 to 40 years comes to about 0.9% of GDP. And Social Security's costs are supposed to rise as a whole to about 6.2% of GDP by sometime in the 2040s, and then decline to about 6% of GDP. Now, given the fact that we have an aging population in this country, 6% of GDP, again, it doesn't seem like a very high price to pay. And so a lot of the sort of alarms about Social Security are really very misplaced, I think. And they also tend to ignore reality. If we have an aging population, number one, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It means less pressure on the educational system. It means possibly wages will rise because there will be proportionately fewer working-age people. So maybe those people will finally get a raise after about 40 years in terms of real income. There's a lot of reasons that it's not really a bad thing. And the GDP figures show you essentially that if you are going to have an aging population, you're going to have to pay a little more for it. To think that can somehow be eliminated or magically, wished away, which I think is what a lot of the people who criticize Social Security seem to think in the back of their minds. That's not true. If you have a system that is geared to maintaining the income of elderly people, that's a good thing for society, even if it costs a little bit more to do it. I think part of the fallacy of people who want to privatize Social Security is that somehow you can save and invest your way around the fact that the population is aging, so you don't have to deal with that problem. That's not true. It's a kind of magical thinking, and I think that comes out pretty clearly in my book.
And the book is The People's Pension. We're talking with author Eric Larson. What strikes me is that the young will get old. Mm-hmm. Secondly, isn't it obvious? I mean, what's the alternative? If you cut Social Security, then either people are left with supporting their elder relatives or allowing their elder relatives to die or to slip into poverty. And when more and more young people are poor, if they can't support their elderly relatives, what's going to happen?
Well, precisely. And that's exactly the situation we had during the Great Depression, which led to an enormous groundswell of support for some kind of an old age income support program. That's what gave birth to Social Security. We're on the verge of a retirement crisis in this country again because of the fact that home equity has declined. People are finding it harder and harder to save on their own. Employers are canceling their own pension programs. Wage stagnation has made it harder and harder for people to save. And all of those things are coming together right now, right at the time that a lot of people in Washington are calling for reducing Social Security. you know, this to me is crazy. They should be looking at ways to expand it. It's a very efficient program administratively. It could be expanded to include more people and to serve people who are already in it better. That's what we need to be talking about, because these other forms of old age income are declining. That's a major reason that I wanted to write this book, because it seemed to me that this whole debate over Social Security for the last 30 years ago has been really upside down. We should be talking about improving and expanding this program, not ways to cut it back.
Let's talk a little bit more about the program. First of all, this term entitlements. I don't remember that being the term that was applied to Social Security when I was young. Isn't this a loaded word?
It is. The word entitlement kind of evolved into being in the 70s as a technical term for government programs that kind of were on autopilot, that they continue to pay out money unless Congress passed a specific law stopping them from doing it. So that included everything from Social Security, unemployment insurance, to aid to families with dependent children. And it acquired a bad name in the 70s when people who were critics of Social Security started to use it as a way to refer to Social Security and Medicare. And the implication was, these are people who feel entitled. They're people who are, they're somewhat babyish about them. They feel like this is their money and that they are entitled to it.
The 47%.
Exactly. It's the sort of thing that Mitt Romney, this caricature he was making of certain parts of the population. And, of course, it's actually a misnomer when you apply it to Social Security and Medicare, because Social Security and Medicare are funded by their own sources of income. We pay payroll taxes to support them. We're entitled because we paid for it. It's not something that's being given to us out of the goodness of Washington's heart. It's something we earned.
And payroll taxes aren't even particularly progressive, are they?
No, they're not. You pay payroll taxes up to a certain portion of your income. They apply to the first $110,000 of your income. Beyond that, you don't pay any tax. And there's a reason for that, because the rationale is that somebody who's making $1 million a year shouldn't get Social Security based on $1 million a year. It's there to provide a sort of a basic income for people. It's not there to replace an affluent income. But the result is that you pay proportionately more of your income in Social Security payroll taxes if you make below $110,000 than if you make more than that. Some people get very outraged about this, but there are offsets. There's the earned income tax credit, which goes mainly to lower income people, and that offsets a lot of the regressive effects of the payroll tax. So to say that Social Security is somehow regressive just by itself doesn't really take into account how the tax system as a whole really works.
You make the point in the book, Eric Larson, in your book, The People's Pension, that the idea of raising the cap, even, say, a moderate amount, has been completely off the table. And I find myself screaming at the radio or the TV when it's never mentioned, and they act as if there's no other remedy except to cut Social Security benefits. So I want to ask you first about, is there a way to raise that cap that would make sense? And then I'll ask you, you know, what's the real effect of the kinds of proposals that are on the table now?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. The ironic thing about the reaction to the proposal to raise the cap is that it's often the same people who love to make the point that Social Security payroll taxes are not a progressive system, they're regressive. Raising the cap would make it more progressive, and yet they oppose this. And they do it in sort of a blanket way. We shouldn't be raising taxes on anyone. That's the line of, let's say, Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan. People in the Democratic Party who are on the center-right who favor cutting Social Security sometimes give lip service to raising the cap, and they say, well, yeah, that's a good idea. It's not the whole solution, but it's a good idea. The Bowles-Simpson plan, which embodies a lot of sort of center-right ideas, does include raising the cap, but it would do it in something like 2050. In other words, we won't do it unless the more drastic cuts that we want to make don't do the job, which is basically pushing it off probably into it'll never happen. So that's the kind of treatment that idea gets. Now, there's three major ideas that are being tossed around pretty frequently for how to cut the cost of Social Security. One is to change the formula that's used to compute benefits when you hit retirement so that it would be stingier. They replace the consumer price index with what they call the chained consumer price index, which is a stingier measure. The second idea is to raise the age for receiving benefits. The third thing is to cut benefits for upper-income people. Now, there's problems with all three of these. If you raise the retirement age, that's effectively a very major cut in benefits for everybody. And we did that before. In 1983, when the last major revisions to the Social Security Act were made, the retirement age was raised from 65 to 67 gradually. And that's something like a 13% cut on average in people's Social Security benefits.
I know. I was shocked. I thought until I read your book that actually I was going to start getting Social Security at age 65, and that's not true.
Yeah, it was raised gradually, slowly enough so most people didn't notice. That's the idea. The second idea is to cut benefits for upper-income people. There's two problems with this. The first is that if you do that, you get less support for Social Security from upper-income people. It becomes more of a welfare program. And we know what happens to welfare programs in this country in this day and age. They get cut. So you leave Social Security politically much more vulnerable. The other problem with it is that it doesn't really do much. You can cut Social Security benefits for the Bill Gateses of the world, but there are not that many of them. When a fairly serious idea was examined in 2005 by the Bush administration to cut benefits for upper-income people, what they discovered is that in order to make any real impact, they had to dig pretty far down into the middle class. So you'd have people making $50,000, $60,000 a year who would be taking pretty major cuts in their benefits. Now, those are not super affluent people or even really affluent people at all. The other idea is to change the benefit, make it a stingier formula for computing the benefit. The problem here is basically that Social Security is not an overly generous benefit to begin with. It was cut in 1983 already because of that retirement age hike. Social Security is one of the least generous national pension systems of any industrialized country. Half of the people on Social Security rely on it for 90% of their retirement income. And that's being cut in other ways because more and more people are paying out-of-pocket health expenses out of Social Security. Medicare premiums, when they go up, those are taken right out of your Social Security check before you get it. So the benefits are not that generous, and 20 million people a year are kept out of poverty because of Social Security. And one of the things that really bothers me in the discourse about this, especially the way it's discussed in the media, is that when articles are written or reports are written about what's needed to balance Social Security's books, okay, we can cut the CPI that's used to compute benefits by this much, they never tell you what the impact would be on actual beneficiaries. How many people will be thrown into poverty if they do this over the next 20, 30 years? That's what I'd like to know. We're talking about millions of people who are just barely on this side of poverty already. If you make these little tweaks, they're never little tweaks. They throw people into poverty, and this is something that really needs to be emphasized, is that those are not technical fixes. They are drastic cuts.
We're going back to the cat food era, in other words. We're talking with Eric Larson. His book is The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. Now, another thing you talk about in your book in terms of why this attack on it, you've already spoken, use the term the zero-sum society. You bring it down to taxes, and I wonder if you could talk about what has happened in terms of, you know, wealth and income inequality in this country. Why, at a time when effective tax rates on the wealthy are the lowest they've been since, you know, maybe the beginning of the early years of the 20th century, what's going on here? What's the issue around taxes and the attack on Social Security?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the problem with taxes is that for the last 40-something years, dating back to the Carter administration, not the Reagan administration, but the Carter administration, capital gains taxes have been cut, other taxes have been cut. There's been sort of a never-ending stream of tax cuts that have largely favored the wealthy. And the problem is that, first of all, again, it means that today It changes our society. Today, the wealthy live in a very, very different world than the rest of us, much more so than was true in the 70s or even the 80s. They can afford things the rest of us can't afford. They have security that the rest of us don't have. Their way of looking at the world has changed profoundly because they live in a kind of a... the tax system and the way it's allowed them to build up wealth has allowed them to kind of build a cocoon around themselves that means that they don't have a lot of empathy. They tend not to have a lot of empathy anymore with the rest of society. And you can see this politically in the, you know, in what's happened, the disappearance of sort of moderate Republicans, for example, and in the shift in the Democratic Party to the center right. And that all has to do with the fact that the political system is fueled by money, is greased by campaign contributions, and the interests of the wealthy have changed, and so the interest, the orientation of the political parties has changed as well to match that. So that's one problem, and that creates an inherent problem for programs like Social Security. They're built on social solidarity. They're built on the idea that everybody at every income level gets something out of this. That's why they call it social insurance. And we provide for this in a cooperative manner with each other. You know, when you hear people on the right complaining about big government and sort of donning this sort of libertarian mantle of I'm for small government, really what they're against is not government. It's against any kind of a system that provides for a kind of a, you know, collective benefit or cooperative or mutual aid type of benefit, like Social Security. People on the right are very fond of spending lots of money on the military and on Homeland Security and police. They just don't like anything that would require them to be part of a social insurance system with other people. So those are the kind of problems the tax system creates. The other problem, of course, is stagnating wages. You know, when Social Security was last revised in a major way in 1983, it was those changes were projected to keep the program solvent well into the 2050s. Now that's been the projections are now down to the 2030s. The main reason for that is not the aging of the population. That had very little to do with it. That was all predicted and factored in. It's the fact that wages have stagnated. Wages stagnate. That means less money going into payroll tax. That means less money to pay Social Security benefits. The best thing we could do to get Social Security solvent for the long run would simply to be to give working Americans a real raise, which they haven't had for the better part of the last 40 years.
On the one hand, you have just said that the wealthy don't want to, you know, basically share more of the social pie with anybody else. They also want to take it away with the ideas of privatization, it seems to me. I mean, privatization would mean a huge transfer of even more wealth to the wealthy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it does it a couple of ways. First of all, privatization would mean tens of billions of dollars a year flowing, instead of into Social Security and the trust funds that support it, instead flowing into the financial sector. You know, it's a kind of a funny thing about privatization is, you know, the idea is, well, you know, to give people control of their assets. But really what would be done, the concrete proposals that have come out generally involve creating a set of investment options that people could put their money in. And so the government would be in the business of picking winners and losers from the financial sector, certain mutual funds that people would be allowed to put their money in, and then funneling the money from those people directly into those mutual funds and those mutual fund providers. Seems to me if you really wanted to privatize Social Security, you would simply cancel payroll taxes, figure out how much everybody gets from the trust fund and distribute it to them, and just close it down. What these people want, they don't actually want to do that. What they want to do is set up a system that would funnel that money, where the government would be acting to funnel that money from the individual worker to Wall Street. So privatization in a weird way, when people on the right object to that term, I actually agree with them because it's a kind of a government welfare for Wall Street is what they're really talking about. As far as cutting Social Security, I think that it's important to realize that you know, at the beginning and the end of the day, the goal of the right in this country is to maintain and extend this low tax regime they've built for themselves. And I think their understanding of it is that, again, if we're an aging society, over the next few decades, we're going to have to spend more money on the elderly. And they see their low tax regime as possibly being threatened by this. And that's why they want to take Social Security apart. What they want to do is to shift the responsibility for providing a basic old age income from the collectivity, namely Social Security and Medicare, onto individual working households. That's one of the things they have to do in order to maintain low taxes for themselves.
Okay, so we are under threat here. I know that my son, who's in his early 30s, you know, he doesn't think Social Security is even going to be there for him, which is another thing that actually undermines support for the system, because young people already view it as a fait accompli that it won't be there. What should we do? What can we do to protect Social Security? And what can we do to protect ourselves in case this campaign to destroy it succeeds?
Well, for one thing, we need to sound the alarm that, you know, for people like your son, who may not think of Social Security as something they're going to get, they may be cynical about it, they're going to depend on Social Security more than current retirees and people who are nearing retirement age today, because they are setting out into the working world at a time when, again, the employer-based pensions are disappearing, wages are continuing to stagnate, so it's harder and harder to save. The cost of education, the cost of housing, the cost of everything is these essentials. Healthcare is going up. It's more and more difficult to build up wealth through home equity. That's the kind of world that people who are in their 20s, 30s, and 40s today are beginning to live through. Social Security is going to be more important for them than ever, and so they should be very concerned that it's being cut. It's ironic in the political campaign you hear people like Romney and Ryan saying, well, we won't cut Social Security for the people who are retired or are about to retire. That means it's all going to be heaped, the cuts are all going to be heaped on the young. So we're going to have much less ability to support it, to sustain their requirements themselves. So we need to get the word out that is the reality of what younger people are living through. The other thing is, actually, I kind of take exception to the idea that young people are against Social Security. The polls that I've looked at, I've looked at tons of polls going back decades on the subject of Social Security. Younger people do tend to be skeptical that they'll receive it, and that's because they're bombarded by dubious reports all the time that Social Security is in trouble. But when you ask them whether it's important to them, they say yes. People want Social Security, and they expect Washington to deliver it to them somehow. That's the most encouraging thing in the current political environment, that while people may be skeptical about Social Security, they want it, they understand that they need it, and they expect Washington to make sure it's there. That's why they've periodically punished politicians who work against it, such as when Bush was attempting to push a privatization program in 2005. That led pretty directly to the Republicans losing Congress the following year. And so to say that people are dismissive of Social Security, even younger people, is really not the case.
Eric Larson. We'll talk more with him about the war on Social Security after the break.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with financial journalist Eric Larson about his book, The People's Pension: The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. What will happen if Social Security is killed off? Larson believes it may be necessary for the American people to come together to create an alternative not dependent on politicians. Eric Larson, you're an anarchist, and you know anarchists are supposed to be people who are against the government.
Right.
What's your perspective on this? I mean, is this true? It seems to me that you're pretty committed to a program like this, like Social Security, but you also have some ideas about, if it does go away, what we could do.
Well, yeah, I'd say, first of all, the reason that this all makes sense in terms of my ideological point of view is that Social Security and Medicare are social insurance programs. They're built on the idea of mutual aid, which is something that originated in the 19th century anarchist movement, and it's this idea that people can pool their resources and use those to support each other's needs over their lifetimes. And this is something that was a powerful idea in the 19th century. It informed the idea of social insurance when that was starting to be formulated in more sort of government circles. So there is this always been this element of cooperation, mutual aid, collective provision for people's needs as a basis of these programs, and it has a very tight bond still with the kind of radical ideas that were coming out in the 19th century. Often people who defend Social Security tend to shy away from the idea of it as a sort of a radical idea, but it is. Even today, it's why people like Paul Ryan go around referring to Social Security as socialistic and collectivist, and as though that, you know, invoking Stalinist Russia or something of the sort. Well, what it really is about is mutual aid and cooperative economy. Now, I sort of make two points in the epilogue to my book, The People's Pension. Number one is that Social Security is not a closed system. It's not a kind of something that was created and we've then locked it up and thrown away the key. It's always meant to be a work in progress. And progressive people, I think, in this country, in the Democratic Party, have been on the defensive for so long that they have a very tough time thinking about ways to expand and improve and maybe improve on Social Security, because to do so would seem to open up this Pandora's box where the right wing can suddenly pop out and say, okay, let's privatize it. But I think if we stop thinking of Social Security as a kind of a living thing, as something that needs to respond to the changing needs of the people who participate in it, then it starts to atrophy and it starts to die and people start to find it irrelevant to them. So I think there's a lot of arguments to be made for people in the Democratic Party to be much more imaginative and start to put much more thought into how we can improve and expand it than they have done up to now. As my gloomier thought is that if the right and the center-right get their way, if they're able to dismantle Social Security and start it on a sort of a phase-out over the next few decades, that essentially the rest of us, the 99%, are going to be thrown back into the position of, how do we replicate this? How do we recreate it for ourselves? They're putting us in an impossible position where every household is basically thrown back on its own resources. That's not going to work. We know that. So what do we do next? Well, maybe that would then be time for us to kind of go back to what people were talking about when mutual aid was first discussed in the 19th century, figure out ways to set up systems like this for ourselves outside of government, where they're not subjected to the kind of money politics that is essentially trying to tear down Social Security now. We need to start thinking about going back to ideas like that. A quick anecdote, when universal health care, the national health care system, was first proposed in this country in the early part of the century during the Progressive Era, Samuel Gompers, who was the head of the American Federation of Labor, which is the predecessor of the AFL-CIO, actually opposed it. And the reason he opposed it was, when he talked to his membership, he said, government is in the pocket of the capitalist class and big business, and they will, if they make a promise to the working class, they will not keep it. We need to set up these systems for ourselves. Now, that did not happen over the next couple of decades, and eventually the labor movement came to very strongly support programs like Social Security and Medicare. But I guess the question I'm putting out there is that perhaps in the long run, Gompers turned out to be right, that ultimately the government is perhaps not the best steward for a program like Social Security, because it has been more and more recaptured by sort of the forces of wealth in the last 30, 40 years. And perhaps the ideas that were being thrown out in those earlier periods about how to create, you know, institutions of mutual aid need to be revisited. Maybe we don't want to. Maybe we'd like to preserve Social Security and Medicare and get them back on track and revive the New Deal legacy and that tradition. But if not, we need to figure out what we're going to do next. And it might well be that progressives in this country are going to have to think about ways to do these things outside of government.
Well, it is a terrific book, The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. And this has been a fascinating discussion. Thanks so much, Eric Larson, for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca.
Eric Larson is an independent financial and political journalist and activist. In addition to The People's Pension, he's the co-author of Understanding the Crash. His work has appeared in The Huffington Post, The Nation, and The Village Voice, among others. Next up, Greg Palast wants to safeguard your vote. The election is happening November 6, and the candidates are running neck and neck. A few thousand votes could decide the outcome. But fears are mounting that hundreds of thousands of voters, mostly poor minority voters, students, and the elderly, will find their votes blocked by voter suppression efforts. My guest, intrepid investigator Greg Palast, says these efforts have been devised by Karl Rove and other Republican operatives and bankrolled by billionaires like the Koch brothers. His latest book has a scoop on the scam. It's called Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. It's got an introduction by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and terrific illustrations by cartoonist Ted Rall. Well, Greg Palast, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Glad to be with you.
This was, like all your books, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits was a shocker, filled with shockers, even for cynics like myself. You go through the 9, quote, easy, unquote, steps on how to steal an election in this book. Today, as we're talking with you, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is going to be ruling on the voter ID law in Pennsylvania. Just to start out, what are your thoughts on this law in particular in Pennsylvania?
Well, it's one of 50 states where they're trying to make sure you don't get a chance to vote. There are 9 ways that they are knocking out the votes of citizens. We've totaled up, when I did the analysis for Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, it's called How to Steal an Election, 9 Easy Steps. You add them all up, it's 5.9 million votes from the 2008 election. You say, well, it didn't make a difference. Yeah, it did. 7 senators, Republican senators, would not have been elected. That would have changed America. And this time, it could change the White House. In the case of Pennsylvania, yeah, they are making it more difficult. It's one of the 9 ways of removing voters. We call it ejecting from the polling station when you don't show up with the right ID. Now, that's to prevent the terrible crime of voter ID theft. Like, so if I go in and say, I'm Francesca, I want her ballot, and I put on a wig, and I don't have an ID, so they give me your ballot. It's a terrible crime. It just never happens. It's like levitating. In Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, I have a chapter called Nuns on the Run. In Indiana, with a similar law to Pennsylvania, 10 nuns were barred from voting because they didn't have, you know, photo driver's licenses with them, which was good because they ran from 88 to 98 years old, and they were removed after voting at the same place for many years because they didn't have the ID. They went to the Supreme Court. Justice Scalia, when he was told that 80% of the people that do not have these photo IDs are minorities, and he said, well, if you're black or white, you know, it doesn't matter. The rules apply. And they said, well, it's 17 miles to the average county office to get an ID. He said, well, 17 miles is 17 miles whether you're black or white. So I didn't understand what he meant by that, because obviously if you don't have a driver's license, you can't drive there. It's a full day job just to get an ID. And by the way, you need an ID to get an ID. You know, so like, oh, well, just go to county office to get an ID. Well, where's your ID to get the ID? It's a wonderful con. And we looked, Greg Palast is an investigative reporter, so we looked it up, and sure enough, Scalia has a black BMW. So what he meant, I guess, was that if you have a black Beamer or a white Beamer, it's still 17 miles, which, you know.
It should be a piece of cake.
15 minutes if you're a bit over the speed limit. But here's the real crime. The crime is that there's no crime. In 100 years of record keeping, not one single person, let alone a nun, has ever committed the crime of voter theft ID in Indiana. So the question is, what is this trying to prevent? It's not to prevent voter ID theft. It's to prevent the voter. You have to understand these ID laws, the feds, the Obama administration till recently didn't even challenge these things. It's been going on all over the place, 22 states.
Well, let's go back to the beginning here, because you start out with Karl Rove, who has been quite central, it seems, to the Republican move across the country in many states to suppress the vote. Tell us about Rove's plan, which he seemed to be unusually candid about, to suppress the black vote in North Carolina.
Well, yeah. In fact, actually, there's an excerpt from the book up at gregpalace.com right now about Rove just said, here's why Obama's likely to lose in 2012. And if, by the way, if Obama loses because people vote him out, that's fine with me. I'm not in any one party. I'm not speaking for any candidate. I just want the voters to make the decision, not Karl Rove. But Rove has a different idea. He said very bluntly, you knock down 1% of the vote, of the black vote in North Carolina, and Obama loses that swing state. And you go through state by state, and he has pointed out that the number of black registrants in the United States has declined by 2 million. Now, what's going on there? The number of Hispanics, the number of Latinos on the voter rolls, despite the massive increase in Hispanic citizenship in the last 4 years, despite the massive voter drives, the number of Latinos on voter rolls in America have dropped by 1 million since 2008. What's going on? The answer is that they're being deliberately removed, purged, wiped out. This is a racial Jim Crow apartheid machinery that Rove has put into place. For those who don't know who Karl Rove is, he is called Bush's brain. Though Bush had a nickname for him, named after a Texas flower, he called him a turd blossom. That was his nickname. So turd blossom now has an organization called American Crossroads, which, by the way, is a social service charity under the tax law.
Yeah, we hear about these. I mean, they're even called, with a straight face, social service.
Well, you know, we sometimes use the term big PACs. And Bobby Kennedy, who wrote the introduction to Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, our book, says PACs are treasonous. But when we say PACs, that actually includes these things which aren't PACs, they're worse. They are charities which are really basically electoral hit squads. And what really makes them deeply evil is that it's all confidential. You don't have to say who's giving you money. And he's raised $250 million, and he doesn't have to say who gave it to him. I mean, I know if you look at the beginning of the book, we know one guy wrote a $20 million check is Iceman, the Iceman.
And who is he?
Ah, Iceman Simmons is the kind of poison king of America. He's the principal owner of National Lead, which he changed to NL, and he made his first billion by buying National Lead, which was bankrupt because it had facing all these lawsuits for poisoning, lead poisoning, and basically got the laws changed so that people wouldn't be able to sue for lead poisoning. And the school systems of America were trying to get National Lead to pay for the removal of their deadly lead paint, and he has successfully fought off the schools. That's why he made his first billion. Now he wants to build the biggest waste dump in America, 25 square miles in Texas, which would be right on top of the Oglala water aquifer. Just like people worried about the XL pipeline going across it, this thing would have all of America's nuclear waste, arsenic, cyanide, lead, you name it, all on top of the water aquifer. And his problem, he's a libertarian. He's not a Republican, by the way. Most of these guys aren't Republicans, even though they're putting up the money. They're in it, they're investments that they're making. The reason he gave the money to Rove, $20 million, and he said he'll give him $50 million if he needs it, is that he wants to eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency, which is in the Republican platform, which Romney has pledged to do. Now, again, this is not about how Obama's wonderful and Romney's Darth Vader. That's not the issue. It's the issue of what the Iceman has put up $20 million so far, and he's even talking $50 to $100 million because he wants to eliminate anyone that would tell him that you can't poison people so you can make another $1 billion. He's worth $10 billion.
And in fact, he's the number one GOP donor.
At this point. You know, you don't even really know who the donors are. And this is one of the things I'm trying to point out in the book. For example, I have a lot of chapters on the Koch brothers, who people have finally woken up to. And there's Iceman Simmons, there's the Vulture Paul Singer, John the Snake Paulson, who I ran into this morning, multi-billionaires. But then there's F8, F8 LLC. What is F8 LLC? They've given $1 million to Romney. Who are these guys? I look it up. F8, when I go through a bunch of documents, find out it's run by a guy named Diego Villaseñor. Now, you may know who Diego Villaseñor is if you're a prodigious gamer, because I looked up the images, and Diego Villaseñor, you'll see his picture of Mr. F8, one of Romney's biggest donors in Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, is, of course, the assassin from Grand Theft Auto. He's a cartoon. But he's somehow given $1 million to Mitt Romney, and that's legal.
No, wait a second. He's what?
I guess you've never played Grand Theft Auto. he's a pretty nasty looking assassin, and he's even more frightening is that he's not American. That's, by the way, one of the things I'm trying to get across with in my discussion in Billionaires and Ballot Bandits about Citizens United. People say, oh, corporations can now give. I'm not worried about Exxon. They've been given forever. What I'm worried about is F8. Who is F8? It's just someone who basically spent $20 incorporating in Delaware and stuck $1 million into this shell and then sent it on to Romney. F8 has sales of whatever it is it sells of $80,000 for last year. If your sales are $80 million, how do you make $1 million contribution?
But you're saying this guy is posing as a virtual character in a game.
Yeah.
I mean, this organization.
So the question is, who's holding the joystick? And we are not allowed to ask, and it's none of our business. As I say in Billionaires and Ballot Band, it's none of our business if he shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. You know, we can't know anymore. That's the deep evil of Citizens United. And the second evil of Citizens United is that Diego Villaseñor, not only is he virtual, but he's not a U.S. citizen. Mm. You don't have to be a U.S. citizen anymore. Take two things. One, we have the Chinese army, as you know, has its own factories. And they sell in the United States. The Chinese army is incorporated in the U.S. It makes clothing for Walmart under the New Order label. I can't make this up. So the Chinese army makes New Order clothes for Walmart. But they have the right, the Chinese have the right now to donate, you know, 10, 20, 30 million bucks to whomever. And as John McCain, of all wacky guys, has pointed out, you know, he's so dotty that he actually
tells the truth.
Lets out the truth once in a while.
And we're speaking with investigative journalist Greg Palast about his book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. Well, let's go back to how they suppress the vote, because you have loads of stories here. Tell us the story of Congressman Tim Griffin. He's a congressman now, but he wasn't always.
No.
His connection to Karl Rove.
Yes.
And the whole issue of caging, which actually threw off a lot of military voters.
Yes. Caging is a system in which you send a voter a letter, and you say, do not forward. You have to send that first class, therefore, do not forward. And if it comes back from the voter's registered address, you say, aha, fraudulent address, challenge the voter's vote. Sounds, on the surface, quite reasonable, except that the letters were sent to students at black colleges in August during their summer vacation, so of course they weren't at their address. It was sent to, and then this is the really sick one, they sent it to the naval station. I actually have these lists. They sent these caging letters to the Jacksonville Naval Air Station, the official address of hundreds of our soldiers African-American soldiers. Why weren't they at their registered address at the military base? Because they were in Afghanistan, they were in Iraq, wherever the heck we had a new war to fight. And so when the soldiers would mail in their ballot from overseas, they didn't even know it, but their ballot was challenged and they lost their vote. Karl Rove and his assistant, Tim Griffin, basically illegally knocked out all these minority soldiers. Now, the reason I say illegally...
This was 2004?
Yeah, okay. When it started, but now it's gotten worse. The problem is, it's a crime. They should be in jail, but they've gotten away with it, and that's the problem. So they now have, dear Mr. Rove has his data mining operation called Data Trust, which he's combining with a big computer operation created by the Kochs called Themis. And you put those two together, and they can brilliantly target voters for an attack. And since they've done it, and they did it in Wisconsin, they've done it in Florida, they've done it in Ohio, they've done it in Pennsylvania. And in Florida, they finally had to sign a stipulation because I caught them. They had to technically say they would never do it again. But this, they keep signing these decrees saying they'll never do it again, but they keep doing it because they do get away with it. Tim Griffin ran this operation. It's an illegal operation, and when I busted the story first on BBC, believe it or not, Karl Rove had him named a federal prosecutor, so that this criminal was named a prosecutor. He resigned because they thought the heat was going to be on, but then the Koch brothers gave this guy $164,000 to run for Congress, so now he's a congressman.
That's Tim Griffin. He was the attorney general then.
He
resigned, and now he is a congressman. Now, he also had an assistant himself by the name of Matt Rhodes. Tell us who Matt Rhodes is.
So Rove's right claw was Griffin, and Griffin's right claw is a guy named Rhodes, who is today... He's not in jail either. Instead, he is the campaign manager for Mitt Romney. So you have a guy who made his bones with the Rove mob by knocking out black voters, and now he's campaign manager. Do you feel safe? And now these guys have a super-duper computer combined with the Kochs computer. Come on. And, you know, I got to tell you, the naivete of some of our Democratic politicians and some of the officials, these guys are really good at what they do, and they know they get away with it, and that's how it is. And they are shameless. When I caught them, first they say the caging lists were their donors, and I had a list to the Bush-Cheney campaign. I said, oh, you get a lot of donations from a homeless shelter? Because there are hundreds of names from a homeless shelter that I had. So I said, now give me the real story. They said, you wouldn't want fraudulent voters to vote. See, they keep going back to the same thing, that they're uncovering fraud, illegal voters.
Well, you know, this has actually been one of the reasons why it seems to me that Mitt Romney really doesn't care about the political pronouncements or this, you know, taking on Paul Ryan, who is... likely to be such baggage around the issues of Medicare and Social Security because, you know, is it because they know that they can just steal the election? And can they? I mean, do you think that there's enough awareness now that they're being beaten back?
We'll find out. And I would note that, like, someone like Paul Ryan, he carries baggage, but the bags are filled with cash. Paul Ryan, in Billionaire's Ballot Bans, one thing you'll find out is that Paul the Vulture Singer, who is the most important donor for Mitt Romney, he's put in millions, but it's not the biggest. Fortune correctly calls him the key, because he's the one who organizes his fellow billionaires. In fact, today I try to grab the Vulture at breakfast. He was having breakfast at Romney this morning with a couple of other billionaires. I try to grab, you know, to see if I could intercept him, but no luck. Nevertheless, the reason Ryan's on the ticket is that Paul the Vulture Singer wants him on the ticket, told Romney to put him on a ticket. And that I got, by the way, that wasn't even me. That was the Wall Street Journal.
Now Paul Singer, we've talked to you about him before. You featured him in your last book. Mm-hmm. But for our listeners, give us a brief description of who he is. Why is he so important in this story?
Singer the Vulture. I didn't give him that name. His bankers did, because he knows how to pick apart carcasses of dead things like poor corporations, poor nations, poor people. And he makes his money by so-called, he calls them investing. What he does is he gets a hold of the debts. He's a massive multi-billion dollar international debt collector. and he'll buy up debts of nations in the middle of a civil war or famine. When peace comes and they get foreign aid, he then seizes the foreign aid, or in the case of, like, I was just in the Congo tracing him down, they have a lot of resources, he'll take their resources, not to get repaid, because, for example, in the Congo, he paid, like, about $10 million for some debts, but he got $400 million, 40 times what he pays. That's what he does. He squeezes and squeezes and says, give me everything I want, or I'll destroy you. And he gets what he wants.
And why would he be so interested in having Paul Ryan on the ticket?
For several reasons. One, he kind of created Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan was nothing. He even had him did the makeover with the new suits with the big baggy jackets and everything. He basically is coming out of the Vulture's Frankenstein factory. So Paul Ryan is a Vulture creation, not just chosen by Ryan. His Manhattan Institute created the kind of, what do you think, Paul Ryan knows how to write up all these tax plans and do these kind of magical, ridiculous calculations. That's all done by Singer's operation for him. Singer runs the Manhattan Institute, the right-wing think tank, to produce this material for Ryan. So he's a Ryan creation. Why do they need a Ryan creation? What's wrong with Romney? Well, they've never been that much in love with Romney, ever. He's not exactly the sharpest knife in the drawer, and they need someone who has some sharps to basically cut up their enemies. Two of their enemies are Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Now, again, it's not that they're wonderful people, but the Secretary of State, Clinton, and our President, Obama, sent their lawyers into a court this April and said, Paul the Vulture Singer and his band have to be put out of business because they are a threat to the entire international system of finance. And, you know, so he's trying to put Singer out of business. So Singer has to get him. Singer was not that involved in presidential politics, didn't care. Suddenly, Singer has got to take out Obama or punish him so hard that he'll back off, whip him so hard that he'll not try to touch him again. And now, Obama did that, and here's the interesting thing. I wish that I could say that Obama went to court to put the Vulture out of business, to stop ripping off third world nations, because he was trying to do the right thing. The truth is that some big banks who are backing Obama are scared of the Vulture, too. He's going now after some of the big banks. He's going after J.P. Morgan, United Bank of Switzerland, Citibank. Those are backing Obama, the establishment banks, and they find guys like the Vulture, they find these guys really, really scary. So think about it. If J.P. Morgan finds these guys scary, you can imagine, they're scary.
Wow. Well, we're running out of time here, Greg. This is a really fascinating book to read. It's a short read, but quite to the point. It's called Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. We just touched the surface. You'll have to read the book to find all those steps, but it is an eye-opener, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
I appreciate it, and I would tell people also, whether you get the book or not, please go to ballotbandits.org, where you can download gratis 7 ways to beat the ballot bandits, how to at least protect your own vote. So ballotbandits.org. Thanks.
That's right. And we'll post a link to that because what to do about it is a crucial thing. Well, thanks again.
You're very welcome.
And you can read an excerpt from Billionaires and Ballot Bandits at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows. Plus, find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.